Games and trivia. Game on. Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We want to check in on World Cup. Chances are, if you live in any city of any size where there's a television, it's on World Cup. Even here in the U.S., which is considered in some ways a soccer backwater. Everybody's got World Cup fever, so we're going to catch up on the action on the pitch with Ricardo Zuniga. He's a Latin America sports editor for the Associated Press. He's with us from his office once again in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Ricardo, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
But there's more to an international tournament than the sports. There is, of course, the politics of the whole thing. And for more on that, we're also going to go to barbershop regular Dave Zirin. He just got back from Brazil. He's been thinking about these issues for a while now and set down some of those thoughts in his latest book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We caught up with him in Oakland, where he just landed. Dave Zirin, welcome back to you as well.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So, Ricardo, let me start with you. Which match has been drawing the biggest reaction from the people in Brazil?
Well, obviously, the Uruguay-Italy match from last night has been getting a lot of attention. Unfortunately, not only for the sporting side of the match, but because of the latest biting incident by Luis Suarez, the great Uruguay striker who apparently beat Italy's defender Giorgio Chiellini in his shoulder. We know that this is not the first time that Suarez has been involved in this type of incident. This would be his third biting incident after doing it in the Dutch League in 2010 and then in the Premier League in 2013. So FIFA opened a disciplinary proceeding this morning. The Uruguay team has to respond, and FIFA will make a decision before Uruguay's next match, which is on Saturday against Colombia in the round of 16. So this is the talk of the day, without a doubt.
What is up with him? Is he like 6 years old? What is up with that?
That's a good question. We've all been asking the same question since last night. There seems to be some psychological problem with him, or there has to be some deep-rooted issue with him, because this is not normal. We see rough playing football every single day, and you know, kicks, punches, headbutts. Those are all, even though it's dirty play, but those are all within what's considered normal in football. But biting someone is just something that you don't see every day, and certainly if a player does it for a third time, you have to think that there's something wrong there.
Mm. So, Dave, you just got back from Brazil, and you've been writing a lot about the protests. We've been hearing a lot about the protests leading up to the games. Are they continuing? What were your impressions when you were there?
Yeah, I mean, they are still continuing, but they're very, very, very more, let's just say, petite than they were a year ago. In 2013, you had the largest protest that Brazil had seen since the fall of the dictatorship 3 decades ago. You counted the numbers in the millions of the people who were in the streets. When I was there, and this has been reported throughout the country, the numbers are more in the hundreds and the low thousands, you know, no more than 4,000 or 5,000 people since the start of the Cup. And the reasons for that are pretty clear and obvious when you go out there actually to the protests, because you're hearing a lot of news reports that they're not happening because everybody's happy with the Cup and everybody's happy now with the spending that went into it. And that's really not true. I mean, you go out there and the level of the police presence and the militarization is actually, it's very frightening. And so unless you're like a very hardened activist, you're not going to just take the streets and do a protest right now.
So you attribute the fact that the protests have died down to the fact that there's been such a strong law enforcement response. There's been such a strong, you know, police response. You feel that it's really suppressed it. It's just that, but you feel that the sentiments are still very much there.
Absolutely. I mean, you see it in stickers that are on the wall. You see it in the fact that there are still strikes going on throughout the country. I mean, you see the word in Portuguese, greve, that's hung in front of buildings or museums. That's the word for strike. And you also see it when you talk to people. I mean, you see it when Brazil played Mexico. I watched the game in a favela, and there was a huge crowd, favela Alto Branco. There was a huge crowd of people out, but not all of them were rooting for Brazil. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people were rooting for Mexico as a political act in and of itself. But when you go to the demonstration, I mean, it's something that I think is kind of difficult for people in the United States to even understand. like the amount of courage it takes just to walk out and say, I'm going to hold up a sign right now. Because it's not just the police, it's the military.
I want to hear, Dave, hold, stay with us for a minute, because I'm interested in your perspective on whether there'll be kind of some lasting political impact on the country from the games and the protests that arose in response to those games. But Ricardo, can I get your perspective on this? As you're there, you know, all the time, what is your sense of how, now that the games have started, how are people feeling about it in the country?
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons that we haven't been seeing the same amount of people in the protest is that some of the groups that started protesting during the World Cup are unions, for example, and it's easier for the government to negotiate with these unions. Now, I do feel like there is a sentiment throughout the country because the games have been so entertaining and the World Cup has been such a sporting success that some of the people are still, they are still obviously angry at the inequalities in this country and at the all the money that has been spent building stadiums and just setting this World Cup. But maybe they are at the moment, I'm not saying this is going to last forever. After the World Cup, they're probably going to go back to being angry. But at the moment, they are caught up in the World Cup. And you see when you talk to taxi drivers, which I do every single day, the first thing that they ask you is, you know, what team are you rooting for? Who do you think is going to win? And then after that, after a few minutes, they go into start complaining about the problems that Brazil has. But their first subject of conversation is going to be, who are you rooting for? Who do you think is going to win the World Cup?
So, Dave, let's talk a little bit about, I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that soccer, football, as it is in the rest of the world, has not been a major subject of interest for Americans, but that seems to be changing, at least according to the ratings. It says that the World Cup ratings have entered elite territory, according to, you know, several news reports, that the total U.S. viewership actually surpassed the NBA Finals and the most recent World Series. So what do you think about that, Dave? I mean, do you think that this is setting a new benchmark, and why do you think that that might be?
I mean, it stomped the NBA Finals and the World Series, and it was roughly commensurate with the college football championship as well. And this is USA versus Portugal. And it's going to be very interesting when the USA plays Germany, which is during a work day on a Thursday. I predict right now these will be scandal, Kerry Washington-style ratings for this game this Thursday. That's in people turning in the middle of the day to watch this game against Germany. I have friends who work in the restaurant industry in D.C. and have been doing it for 20 years, and they say they've never seen anything like it. One of them said to me that it used to be that, you know, you would make fun of your friend if they were into the World Cup. Now it's you're making fun of your friends who aren't finding time for the World Cup. So there is that kind of a sea change that's taking place. Some of it is rooted, I believe, in immigration in the United States and people bringing their soccer love into the country. Some of it is rooted in the Internet and the fact that people are able to follow soccer, particularly Europe and the English Premier League throughout the year, and now they're following their favorite players into the cup. And some of it is rooted absolutely in the fact that this has been the best World Cup in eons, already more comeback victories than in the entire 2010 World Cup. So there's a lot of ways in which the stars are aligning right now.
Ricardo, what are the games that are coming up that people are most interested in, or the matches coming up that people are most interested in?
First, there's the Argentina-Nigeria match today in Porto Alegre. This has also a component, a social component that's kind of has the authorities here on guard. They are expecting around 80,000 Argentine fans in Porto Alegre. This is a city in the south of Brazil, closest to the Argentine border, and so they expect around 80,000. Only around 20,000 have tickets for the game, so that obviously is a recipe for trouble if you have 60,000 rowdy fans in the streets of a city. We've already seen some clashes between Argentine and Brazilian fans in Belo Horizonte, so the authorities are on high alert on that one. And looking forward to the round of 16, there are going to be some excellent matches between Colombia and Uruguay. That's going to be on Saturday in Rio de Janeiro. And Brazil and Chile, that's going to be on Saturday too in Belo Horizonte. Mm. Those have been some of the most entertaining teams. So we are expecting some great, great football in the coming days.
And Dave, can I get a final thought from you about how you're not in Brazil full time, but you've been spending a lot of time there and thinking about the way that preparing for these games what it's brought forward in terms of among Brazilians about how they feel about their country, how they feel about resources are being expended in their country. The Summer Olympics are coming up. Brazil's also hosting those in 2016. Do you see a sense that the way people are thinking about these games, even though they've been successful athletically and it's been very exciting, is that sort of changing the country in any way that you think will have some kind of future impact?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, you know, it doesn't take a fortune teller to see that these issues aren't going to go anywhere precisely because they're hosting the 2016 Olympics. So all of the issues that I talk about in the book and that people are dealing with, like the militarization of public space and displacement and debt, all of these things are going to continue as public lightning rod issues over the next 2 years. That's just going to happen. The second thing is that there are elections in Brazil this October, and it's probably going to act as a referendum about how these mega events are being handled. So these issues are not going anywhere, Michelle. We're going to continue to talk about them. Brazil is a country that's bigger than the continental United States. It's got over 200 million people. It's a very diverse, vast, and difficult-to-read nation. But one thing is certain. I think after the protests last year at the Confederations Cup, the wine is out of the bottle, and it's never going to be the same.
That was Dave Zirin. He's the sports correspondent for the progressive magazine The Nation. His latest book is Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We caught up with him in Oakland, where he's just gotten back from Brazil. Also with us, Ricardo Zuniga. He is Latin America sports editor for the Associated Press, and we reached him at Rio de Janeiro. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Michelle.
Coming up, a biopic is being made about the late R&B singer Aaliyah, but some people aren't thrilled that a biracial actress has been cast to play the African-American songstress.
A lot of people say that I'm not black enough. Half black is just enough. It doesn't matter what color you are, it's about how you portray the character.
The beauty shop ladies weigh in on the latest politics around skin color. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
It's amazing how fast time flies, isn't it? For example, did you know that June 30th is this upcoming Monday? Of course, here at WILL, we've been counting down to that date, as it's the end of our fiscal year. And we've had some amazing support over the last 12 months. In fact, we are now within $100,000 of our overall goal. But time is now of the essence. So if you've been meaning to make a gift, don't delay. Call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org. Thank you.
I'm Robin Young. Author Neil Gaiman's latest stage show combines big screen illustrations, storytelling, and live music.
We walked and climbed and clambered and clung. We slipped and slid and stumbled and staggered. Yet even in the mist, Callum knew where he was going, and I followed him.
Next time on Here Now from NPR and WBR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for a visit to the beauty shop, where our panel of women journalists and commentators take a fresh cut on the week's news. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Diona Kelly Saeed. She's a freelance writer. Sorry. Excuse me. Sorry about that. I was just overcome with emotion at talking to Diona again. She's a freelance writer and editor of the website Love Inshallah. Nana Mensah is an actress on the web series An African City. Writer Veronica Miller is a contributor for XO Jane and TheGrio.com. And Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor of PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian news and commentary site. Welcome back, everybody.
Hey, Michelle.
Thank you.
Hello.
So let's start with a political story. And I just have to tell you that the elements of it might be disturbing for some people to hear. So with that being said, this is about Hillary Clinton. She's back in the news over a case that people that might become important if she decides to run for president, as many people think that she will. This goes back to 1975 when she was a young lawyer. She was in her 20s, and she defended a man accused of raping a 12-year-old girl. Now, this is not the first time that this case has come up, as you might imagine, with somebody with such a long political career. But this week, the Washington Free Beacon, which is a conservative media outlet, released audio tapes from the mid-1980s of Hillary Clinton talking about the case with journalist Roy Reed. And in the tapes, Clinton seems to be laughing about the case and seems to allude to believing that her client was, in fact, guilty. Now, the audio is a little difficult to understand. We're just going to play a short clip of it, but you do want you to understand that the audio exists, so here it is.
Of course, he claimed that he did. He took a lie detector test, which he passed, which forever destroyed my faith in politics.
Now, if you couldn't understand what she was saying, Hillary Clinton says the man she defended took a lie detector test, a polygraph, which he passed, and that forever destroyed her faith in polygraphs. The client eventually pleaded guilty to a lesser charge, and Clinton said that he was released with time served. But the girl who was the accuser in this case is now a 52-year-old woman, and she spoke with the Daily Beast earlier this week, and she says she's still angry about this case. She's angry about the way that Clinton defended her client, saying that she did that by smearing her reputation. And she says that if she could speak to Clinton directly, she would say, "You lied on me. I realize the truth now, the heart of what you've done to me, and you're supposed to be for women. You call that being for women what you've done to me," you know, unquote. So I wanted to ask all of you about what you think about this, both the facts and what are being made of the facts. And Bridget, why don't you start?
Well, you know, first of all, I listened to that tape, and I think it reaffirms my beliefs about defense attorneys. But, you know, I can say from experience, cops and prosecutors also make off-the-record crass comments. Now, though, if you look at the recent history of how controversial criminal cases have affected Washington, though, she could be in a bit of trouble, not for the case itself, but that this is coupled with the Dems' war on women message. You know, for example, you look at the Debo Agabdile nomination that was blocked for the Justice Department, and some Senate Democrats joined in on that, and it was not just because he had represented Mumia in that case, but that they felt that he was participating in the PR campaign that smeared the victim. And so,
okay, but that's not the case here. That, I don't know, was there a PR campaign here? I mean, so can we stick to the facts of this particular case?
No, so I'm just saying that it's not the fact that she defended a rapist that could come back to haunt her, but comments surrounding it and comments coupled with the fact that the Democrats are using the war on women meme at the moment.
Veronica Miller, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I mean, I think the comments that she made can be, you know, a little unsettling and a little disarming when you listen to it. But I have a hard time thinking that the party that brought us legitimate rape will, you know, suddenly become advocates of the way rape victims are treated in criminal cases in this issue. So I've looked a little bit into the commentary on this, and there's honestly more commentary about Hillary's, you know, we were poor, we were broke comments from, like, I think last week or the week before than there is about this case. I think it's just hard to, you know, for the right to turn this into a smear campaign against Hillary Clinton, because then they would have to become advocates of women's rights in rape cases.
Nana Mensah, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's a little unsettling, to be honest. But at the same time, it's like at the time she was, what, 27 years old and, you know, scrappy and trying to establish her name as a defense attorney. And I agree with Veronica. It's kind of the lesser of two evils here. I mean, I don't believe that the Republican Party is the party to champion women's rights. And so if I'm picking between the lesser of two evils, my vote stays with Hillary, you know?
Dana, what do you think?
Well, actually, I have a little bit of personal experience with a very similar situation. When I was around 11 or 12, I was sexually assaulted, and the outcome of the case was greatly determined by local politics. So I know what it's like to have the system fail you, and sometimes that trauma is even harder to deal with than the sexual assault. It does make me question Hillary Clinton's ethics. However, just as I would not want an event that happened to me when I was 11 or 12 to determine the sum of my existence, I would not take a professional decision Hillary Clinton made in her late 20s to be the sum of her current existence either. And I find it offensive that partisan politics is probably behind the current leak of the audio, which Agreed. Is, again, taking rape to be somehow a politicized endeavor rather than a real personal trauma that somebody experienced as a young girl.
Can I just say one thing, Bridget? You talked about, you know, the ethics of defense lawyers, and I have to say, well, I think most people know my husband is a defense lawyer. And before that, he was a prosecutor. I mean, he was a prosecutor for 17 years.
Right.
So both working on both the local and the federal level. And I always find it interesting when conservatives criticize a fundamental right, which is to have counsel. And I guess I'm just sort of wondering, so how do you have a right if there's nobody willing to activate that? I mean, elsewhere in the world, when lawyers are attacked like they are in Egypt for defending, or in China, when they are, you know, attacked for defending unpopular clients, right? Then, you know, people want to step in and say, oh, you know, but when it comes to defending unpopular people in the United States, somehow they're wrong for doing that. I just wonder how you square that up.
Well, yeah, I don't think that it's denying people the right to have capable defense. I think that it's something where people's emotions play into it, and they see a horrific case, and they see, you know, oh, you know, how could you have defended a Ted Bundy, or, you know, a person who...
But that's why we have rules, isn't it? So that emotions are mediated. That's what the whole purpose of a system is.
I'm not saying they should play into it, but I'm just talking about the reality of how people view situations like that.
If you're just joining us, we're having our beauty shop conversation. We're talking about the week's news with Bridget Johnson, Anna Mensa, Diona Kelly-Seed, and Veronica Miller. Diona, I just want to take 1 minute to say I'm really sorry about what happened to you before we move on. I don't want to let that moment go, but say I'm sorry that happened to you, and it should not have happened to you. But so let's turn to another story. It's not quite as serious, but this is the kind of thing that's very serious to some people. It's interesting. It kind of pushes a lot of buttons in a similar kind of an emotional way. We're talking about the biopic that's getting a lot of attention. The Lifetime Network has announced that they'll be making a movie about the late R&B singer Aaliyah, and already there seems to be some drama. Aaliyah's family is not supporting the film, saying Aaliyah was an American music icon who deserves to, quote, have a tribute much more grand than a television network debut that won't even consider the perspectives of those closest to Aaliyah. So there's that. And then there's the question of her secret marriage to the very controversial singer R. Kelly. She was 15 and then he was 27. Is there a question about whether that will be addressed? But there's also this whole thing going on, Veronica, I'll start there with you, that Disney Channel actress Zendaya has been cast to play Aaliyah. Zendaya is biracial. Her mom's white, her dad's black. And some people apparently on social media are saying that she's the wrong choice for this. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I'm in that generation. I was one of the girls where, you know, Aaliyah was our icon growing up, right? She was this brown girl from the city, and she dressed in urban clothes, and she liked to sing and dance just like the rest of us did. She just, you know, got famous doing it. And so when, you learn that you cast this young girl, Zendaya, who I think is only 17, you know, to us looks nothing like Aaliyah. And, you know, she is lighter skinned, and I'm cautious about approaching, you know, skin color politics. But in this case, Aaliyah's appeal was the fact that she was a brown girl. You know what I mean? And so when you cast somebody that doesn't look like her and, you know, lightens her up, it kind of takes that part of her story out of it, and it takes away, you know, the significance that she had to the rest of us. So, you know, that's the controversy over, you know, if you want to represent one of, you know, our icons for our generation, do it, you know, accurately. It's kind of parallel to the Zoe Saldana, Nina Simone thing that popped up last year.
What do you think, Nana?
I totally disagree. I mean, I feel like Zendaya, I mean, I am of that same group, and Aaliyah was also an icon to me as well. I don't think that they look that dissimilar. And this might be, and that's semantics, but I mean, first of all, this speaks to a larger argument of racial identity for black people in this country. And often you hear that, like, I'm not black, I'm a quarter Irish and a 16th Inuit and whatever. It's like, girl, you're black. Like, sit down. You know, it's like Lenny Kravitz is black, Halle Berry is black, Barack Obama is black. Like, I don't think this, you know, half this, quarter that, 16th that. Like, I think that question is beginning to be irrelevant as we are, you know, mating with each other, and interracial and biracial relationships are starting to, you know, I don't think we can start splitting hairs like that anymore. Or I think we have to stop splitting hairs like that.
What about, does anybody else want to weigh in on this? Bridget, do you care?
I mean, I was thinking more of the...
I'm just thinking about this because Zendaya, I mean, from my perspective, Zendaya is such a... She is kind of an icon for young girls today because she's so fabulous. I mean, she sings, she dances, and she does all that stuff. And her show at Disney was super fun and, you know, talked about, you know, girls wanting to be ambitious for something for themselves. You know, girls who were the age, Veronica, that you were then when Aaliyah was big are loving Zendaya. So you can certainly understand why she's an icon for them. But Bridget, what do you think as the non-black person? How about that?
I mean,
to your knowledge, as far as you know.
Well, you know, I would say that the melting pot is just going to you know, make us more meltier, shall I say. You know, everything's just going to be, you know, not, you know, more mixed and everything. So we should probably not focus on that too much. I would be upset if somebody was making a Lifetime movie out of me. But, you know.
Because full stop, right?
A Lifetime
aspect of it. Okay.
Well, you know, at least that you know they'd be crying, right? At least you know they'd be crying involved. Fiona, do you care? What do you think?
I just think it's interesting, this whole American fascination with celebrity and reinterpreting celebrities who have passed, reinterpreting their identity, and even making them lighter than they really were. It's almost an American fascination to change the story when it's going to be good for ratings, perhaps.
I don't know if that's true. Like, I think that's really false. I think Zendaya looks a lot like Aaliyah, so she happens to be slightly fairer, but I don't think you can compare that to Zoe Saldana and Nina Simone. Nina Simone was inky, inky dark. And again, like I said, I don't want to split these hairs, but, you know, and Zoe Saldana is Dominican. And so, so it's a completely different basis, but Zendaya and Aaliyah look a lot alike. I mean, just because there's a slight gradation difference in color, I don't think that you can say that she's not worthy of being able to play the role.
It's always, you know, the tricky thing for me, though, is always how much to take note of this kind of social media chatter. You know, I think that's part of the problem of our age, is knowing how much weight to give these kinds of conversations that, frankly, you know, you might have, like, in the ladies' room at your high school. You wouldn't even bring it out into the hallway because that's the question, is how seriously do you take it? I think part of that's what this is about. But, you know, speaking of, you know, artists who are gone too soon, that can we take a moment to remember Michael Jackson, who was my icon growing up, right? You know, we all had one Jackson brother that we claimed who was ours. You know, Michael was mine, and today is the 5th anniversary of his death. It turns out that his estate has made some like $700 million since he passed away, which is just kind of remarkable. I'm not quite sure that that says, but do any of you want to share your Michael Jackson memories? Fiona, do you want to share one?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do. I grew up in the rural South in a very racially segregated area, and I remember being like 8 or 9 or 10 when Thriller came out, and it was such a big thing, and so few people had satellites that they bused the white kids to the Civic Center so we could watch it on television. And it was this great moment because it really did transcend race in an area where race was a really big issue.
Nana, what about you?
Well, I'm Ghanaian American, and I spent a lot of time with my family over in the UK. There was, you know, mass exodus from Ghana in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, my cousins that were raised there were Ghanaian Brits. And I remember it's like we had completely different, you know, we didn't use the same slang. Our accents were completely different. But at the same time, it's like when you put on Thriller, it's like we knew all the words, we knew all the dance steps, we knew, you know, and that was this great unifier despite our very, you know, our different cultural backgrounds. It was, yeah, it was a great unifier.
Veronica, what about you? You claimed Aaliyah, so you can't have Michael too. So I'm just letting you know he's mine. But go ahead. But you can share a memory. It's okay.
Well, my very first concert was when I was 5, the Michael Jackson Bad Tour when he stopped in Pittsburgh, and I remember just being absolutely like electrified, and it just kind of started this kind of lifelong obsession with him. And I remember being scared by the Thriller section because there were like werewolves and ghosts, and that was creepy. But I also remember hearing Heartbreak Hotel for the very first time, and it just blew my mind. And then I would go home, and I didn't understand that this person had music from before I was born, so I was looking for it on my Bad album, and it wasn't there, and I was very angry that I couldn't find the song on the current album he had, not knowing it had come out like years before. But yeah, I just still have like a lifelong obsession and reverence for him as a performer and a musician.
Bridget, what about you? Do you have a Jackson 5 or Michael Jackson memory you want to share?
Yeah, you know, my favorite has to be Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror video, because I was a kid at the time and we were being bombarded with, you know, pop stars who are supposed to be the heroes and the role models for us. And then comes a song he puts out there in the video, people who would become my real heroes, like Mother Teresa and Lech Walesa and MLK, and with the message to make that change. So, you know, it was really impactful.
Can I just share mine? Growing up, we did not have a lot of money, but I remember my dad somehow... my parents, I should say, pulling it together to get tickets for all 5 of us to go see the Jackson 5 at Madison Square Garden. And I just remember thinking it was like this just, it was like, I just can't even describe what that was like. I mean, we didn't take vacations. We didn't, you know, do a lot of things like that. But for him to kind of figure out that this was like something important to us, or our parents to figure out and take us. But I also remember, you know, my father was a firefighter. And I remember we had to leave early to beat the rush, you know, to the exits. Okay, kids. And I still remember him like marching us out of there. We're like, what? How can you, like, okay, kids, we got to beat the rush. We got to get out of there. Because my dad, to the end of his days, always had to check the exits. Like, that was like, so. But it's a good memory. So still miss Michael Jackson. So thank you all, ladies. So thank you all for joining us to share those important memories. And Deonna Kelly Said is editor of the website loveinshallah.com. She joined us from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Veronica Miller writes about fashion and pop culture for XO Jane and The Griot, with us from Philadelphia. Nana Mensa is an actress on the breakout web series An African City, with us from Austin, Texas. And Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media, with us from Washington, D.C. Ladies, thank you all so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Just ahead, it's been 2 months since more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted in the north of Nigeria. There are reports that even more children have been abducted by the extremist group Boko Haram. We'll ask a spokesman for the Nigerian government if that's true, and we'll hear about the country's continued struggle against the group. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985. CySimsFoundation.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the extremist Sunni Islamist group ISIS that has taken over parts of Iraq and what that means for Iraq, the region, and the U.S. We talk with Dexter Filkins, who covered the war in Iraq for the New York Times and now writes about Iraq and the region for the New Yorker. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, examining the role of non-white people in, geekdom.
There's a lot of crossover between social justice and sci-fi. And it's going to be more and more because of places like Twitter, because we're having these conversations and we're coming closer together and our voices are becoming unified.
Diversity in fantasy and science fiction. That's this week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's go now to developments in Nigeria. It's been more than 2 months since more than 200 schoolgirls were abducted by the extremist group Boko Haram. People around the world campaign to bring back our girls. Of course, there was a widely used Twitter hashtag campaign using that term. The story seems to have mostly fallen out of the headlines in many countries around the world. Meanwhile, the Nigerian government says it has wrapped up an inquiry into the case, yet there are witness reports that more children may now be missing. Here to give us the latest is freelance journalist Chika Odua. She's been keeping us updated since the abduction first took place. She's with us from Maiduguri. Chika, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
We are also hearing from a representative of the government. That is Dr. Doyin Akupe. He is a medical doctor, but we are hearing from him once again in his capacity as Senior Special Assistant on Public Affairs to President Goodluck Jonathan. He's with us from Abuja. Doctor, welcome back to you as well. Thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you very much.
And so, Doctor, let us begin with you. We understand that the government's official inquiry into the whole situation has been concluded. Have you seen this report? Does it shed any light on what happened or where the girls might be?
Yeah, I've had the privilege of seeing the report. And it's a very detailed report. It's also some form of, it has been classified as a run, it's been made to be a classified document because it contains some issues that were very closely related to national security. But then, you know, basically, in essence, you know, what it says is that, you know, on the night of the abduction, which we didn't, I mean, nobody spoke about this before, that some 119 girls from the hostel actually did escape. This was the first information. And when you take that and take the number of girls that have now returned, officially, from that report, 219 girls are yet to be accounted for. That is what the report, in summary, has said.
You were telling us that the report is considered classified because it contains sensitive national security information. Well, when we last spoke, the government had indicated that it believed it knew where the girls were. It was understood that the rescue attempts would be dangerous. Is that still the case? Does the government still maintain that they know where the girls are being held?
That's a fact. But the military option is the last option, you know, under the circumstances, because of the obvious disadvantage that it may actually lead to, you know, losing some of the girls, you know, because of the nature of the situation which they are in right now.
I understand, Dr. Akupe, that yet more children have been taken. Is that true?
That is not correct. You know, that is absolutely not correct at all. There's no verifiable evidence. There's nothing that can support that claim. We don't know where their news came from. And even the governor of the state himself said on national television that, from where they are, they cannot verify that statement. Hmm. But I can assure you that as of today, you know, information available to government, to the people around, to our security agencies, that story cannot be validated. So, what the world do not know is that there is a lot of politicization of Boko Haram activities and abductions in Nigeria, and people are trying to use that to blackmail government, blackmail the president, and make the government look bad or inept.
Speaking of the president, that when we last spoke, there was criticism that he had not yet visited the area from where the girls were taken. Has he visited the area yet? Has he gone to Chibok?
No, he has not.
He has not
gone to Chibok.
Why is that?
Well, you know, I cannot say, you know, this is why he hasn't gone to Chibok. But, you know, there are a lot of things that are going on. The real problem we have is the consideration of the method and methodology through which we can get these girls released. This is a major, major affair.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about developments in the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls in April. I'm speaking with Dr. Doyin Akupe. He is an advisor to Nigeria's president, Goodluck Jonathan. I'd like to hear now from Chika Odua, who's a freelance journalist that we've been turning to keep us up to date on these developments. Chika, first of all, may I ask, how are Nigerians reacting to this inquiry, which Dr. Akupe was telling us about? I mean, the government says that this inquiry is completed, but that its results are considered classified. How are people reacting to that?
I think for now, Nigerians are trying to keep the pressure on the government to get the girls back from wherever they are. As you can see, the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, which started in Abuja, is continuing strong, and today makes day 72 since the girls have been missing. We understand that 57 girls were able to come back. They were able to escape on their own. They managed to jump out of lorries. They managed to come through the bushes and escape. 219 girls are still missing, but as of date, we cannot say that the government has been able to find any of these girls. The girls who did manage to escape made it back on their own.
The reporting, as Dr. Okupe disputes, that there have been additional children taken. What are your sources telling you?
Well, this story has not been confirmed, and that's why it's been so difficult reporting on it. I am here in Maiduguri, and I did speak to some vigilantes who do say, yes, it happened. But again, no security officials have been able to comment. I reached out to several branches of the Nigerian government, both state, federal, the military, the police, and none of them have confirmed nor denied the story. So right now we have to wait to see what happens.
Because we reached you in Maiduguri, which is in northeast Nigeria, is there something, could you just give us a sense of the area? Is there something that you feel it's important to understand about what's going on in that area that we may not understand from a distance?
Well, Maiduguri itself, so far they've been able to keep Boko Haram away from the city, and this is being done by the vigilante forces in conjunction with the civilian JTF. And of course, they're working with the Nigerian military and trained vigilantes to try to keep the terrorists at bay. So they've been doing a fairly decent job at doing that. So right now you have people flocking from different parts of the northeast into Maiduguri seeking refuge. I just went to a camp this morning where there are more than 4,000 internally displaced families living there, living in the camp. They're being fed from the state government. The state government is handling their feeding and their security. And this is, again, something that the vigilantes have tried to do as far as keeping their city safe, because many of these people say that they're tired of Boko Haram coming and destroying their families, destroying their lives. Mm-hmm. So they decided to take up arms and defend the city, essentially. And they're doing that any way that they can. A lot of them are using bows and arrows. Some of them are using hunter rifles, machetes as well. And you can see them as they're traveling throughout northeastern Nigeria. The checkpoints, some checkpoints are manned by military, some checkpoints are manned by vigilantes, and some are both. This is a state under emergency rule, so security, of course, is something that we have to consider very, very top priority.
Dr. Okupe, can we get a final thought from you? When we last spoke, you told us that you felt that the war between the government and Boko Haram is actually de-escalating. And you said that you felt that the abduction of these girls, which was very, you know, devastating and shocking, was meant to have an impact. But you felt that it was actually indicative of this group's kind of desperation, the fact that their influence is on the wane, that they are on the run, as it were. Do you still think that that's true?
Well, I think that is self-evident, you see, because all previous efforts at attacking the Sambisa Forest has now ceased.
Dr. Doyin Okupe is a medical doctor. We are speaking to him in his capacity as Senior Special Assistant on Public Affairs to the President of Nigeria. Good luck, Jonathan. We reached him in Abuja. Dr. Okupe, thank you for speaking with us once again.
I'm grateful. Thank you very much.
For additional perspective, we also spoke with Chika Adua. She's a freelance journalist. We reached her in Maiduguri, and she has been keeping us up to date on all of these developments throughout this crisis. Chika, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle. It's a pleasure as always.
So I walked my kids to their first day of summer camp, and we had a slight disagreement over exactly where and when I was to let them go. My son preferred that I remain at the foot of the stairs that led into the building. And honestly, if he'd had his druthers, I think he'd have preferred that I stopped at the corner. Whereas my daughter preferred that I walk all the way up the stairs and inside the gym, and truth be told, she probably wouldn't have minded at all if I'd stayed through lunch. I opted to ignore the son eye rolling and go with daughter preference. And I was leaving, I felt great. grateful to have had the luxury of being able to have those extra few minutes to see them off, to have the luxury of being able to, at least in my mind, protect them for those few precious minutes. And then I came to work and heard more about the 52,000 or so children who try to get into the U.S. this year without an adult, and almost needless to say, without authorization, via the U.S.-Mexico border. Why are they coming? Some say it's bad information. They or their parents have heard, wrongly, that if they manage to get here, they will be able to stay here. Others say it's bad information and worse conditions. Criminal gangs are pressing in on them, and they want something better for themselves than a life of poverty, violence, prostitution, and whatever other degradation the world has to offer the children of the poor and powerless. Can I just tell you, it seems to me that the problem of our age and time is the problem of information. There's both too much and too little. It's too little when you send your children on a dangerous journey with no clear idea of what will happen when they get there. But for many of us, it's almost a problem of too much, with too little agency to do anything about it. Now that we know that thousands of little ones, some as young and foolish and frightened as your children and mine, are packed into detention centers sleeping under those foil blankets that they hand out at the end of marathons, what do we do? And while we're at it, now that we know that children as young and foolish as yours and mine are barely surviving as refugees in Jordan from a war in Syria that seemingly has no end, what do we do? Now that we know that more than 200 schoolgirls are still being held prisoner by extremists in Nigeria, what do we do? Now that we know that children all over the world are on the move trying to save their own lives, what do we do? The children of the world are our most precious resource, and yet every day we are reminded of our failure to treat them as such. No one wants to be reminded of failure, so what we want to do, okay, what I want to do, is turn it off and turn away. It becomes so tempting to focus on our own school clothes, our own camp and SATs, and how we individually get what we individually want for ourselves and our own kids, but we cannot turn it off and turn away. How can we? It strikes me that those children coming here without papers, as badly informed, as ignorant as they may be, somehow they come because they trust us in a way that children insist on trusting us even when we do not deserve it. They trust us as the grown-ups to figure it out. A year or so ago, I got the chance to meet a number of freedom riders. People often forget how young they were, not much older than many of those kids pouring across the border now. They risked their lives riding the buses through the still segregated South to force this country to live up to its promise of equal treatment of all citizens. I asked one woman how she told her mother that she was going to leave school to do this. She recalls saying something quite hurtful that she now regrets. She told her, "If you had done this, I wouldn't have to." That question haunts me. Somehow, the children are still doing the work that we have failed to do for them. Finally, today it's time for the latest in our In Your Ear series. That's where we ask some of our guests to tell us about the songs that give them inspiration. In honor of National Caribbean American Heritage Month, we are hearing from a star of Trinidadian soca music.
Hi, hello, this is Bunchy Garlin all the way from Trinidad and Tobago, and this is what's playing in my ear.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it, get slowly, get started.
Black Eyed Peas, Let's Get It Started.
Let's get it started. Let's get it started. Let's get it started. Let's get it started. Let's get it started.
I always liked that song from the first time it was released. It just puts me into that atmosphere of getting ready, party, getting ready to move, getting ready to get work done, getting ready to get something started. Another song that has been playing in my ear, Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. So many things about that song. It just lifts my spirit. There's serious nostalgia when I hear that song. My childhood days come back into play. I remember when my parents were still together, we was in the same household, all that stuff. The whole atmosphere becomes one, something like dreamland every time I hear that song. And I like to dream a lot, so I constantly play that song. Yep. Another song that's playing in my ear is by Drake. Just Hold On, We're Going Home. Just listen, this song alone, I mean, it tells so many stories. Just listening to it. Just hold on, we're going home. It's hard to do these things alone. Just hold on, we're going home. You could visualize your own mini movie in your head when you hear that song. Every time I'm leaving from a show and I'm going home to my wife and daughter, that is the song that I played, and it just keeps me company on the way home to see them, because sometimes it's been a long night and you just need to take it easy to go home.
That was Trinidadian soca singer Bungie Garland telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear our full conversation, please go to our website at the Tell Me More page of npr.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. You act so different around me, 'cause you're a good girl and you know it. I know exactly who you could be. Oh, just hold on, I'm going home. Just hold on, I'm going home.